If you just find your seats, I think we really have better get started as soon as we can. I just said earlier to those people who are in here, if you sit in the front four rows, you may find it easier to see some of my slides, which I'm afraid are rather ill-designed and rather small text on some of them. If you've got good eyesight, you may be fine where you are. No, it can go for now. Good. Well, it's good to see you all here. I've had the experience at this type of event before, where you've got a choice of seminars, and you really want to go to all of them. So thank you for choosing this one. I mean, if in 10 minutes' time you find yourself wishing you were somewhere else, I understand the Christian Coalition for Education will be making recordings of all the seminars available on the web, and if you've left your email address, then you'll get some details of that. So I want to just to outline what I'm trying to cover here. I do think thinking Christianly about our subjects is a critical issue. And it's my hope that we can stimulate one another to think about these issues and to bring our teaching more into line with Jesus' teaching. But can I start by saying that subject content is not the only thing we should be thinking about? We shouldn't just be thinking about what we teach. Jesus said, when a disciple is fully trained, he will be, and I don't know if anyone can finish that quotation, but he goes on to say, he will be like his teacher. Not, he will be like what he is taught. This talk is about what we teach, but if, like me, you're the sort of person who gets excited by some of the ideas, let's keep reminding ourselves that actually who we are as teachers and how we treat our pupils, how we live before them in our professional lives, should be reflecting the character of Christ. And we need to be on our knees daily before the Lord in prayer, seeking his help in that, because it's only as he lives in us that we will show his character to our pupils. But having said that, it is not enough to be humble and loving, self-sacrificing and righteous and just. Our actions must not contradict our words, but nor must our words, what we teach, contradict and undermine God's truth. This is a big topic, so it's really going to have to be a whistle-stop tour this afternoon, but we'll look at why it's important, what it means to think Christianly about the curriculum and what it doesn't mean. What about indoctrination, for instance? It's already been mentioned this morning. I want to say a little bit more about that. How can we begin to think Christianly about a particular curriculum subject? And I also want to look at some practical ideas for how this could be implemented in a school. So let's have a look, first of all, at why. Why would we want to do this? Surely, French is French, and maths is maths, and science, especially science, is science. It's public neutral knowledge. These are shared fields of study. They're public property, not to be claimed by any one religious group. That's probably something you've heard, maybe even thought. That is actually a very similar argument to that that's raised by secularists about public political discourse, the idea that religion and faith are personal things, not founded upon any evidence. It's fine for people to believe them if they really want to, though we can't really understand why they would, as long as they keep it private and keep it to themselves. Ideas which are based in a faith perspective, so it's argued, have no place in public discourse. Religious views have no relevance for public policy. Christians shouldn't bring personal faith into political debates. Only publicly verifiable statements which can be part of our shared understanding of the world are admissible. Well, I think we'd all disagree with that, and we're all familiar with that debate. Our faith in God does mean that we trust him even when we don't understand, but that doesn't mean our faith in him is irrational or that our beliefs are disconnected from evidence. And secular views on all sorts of political and ethical issues are not based on some neutral position. They too are based on a set of unprovable beliefs, on a kind of secular faith. There really is no reason at all why that secular faith should be privileged and all other beliefs ruled out of public discourse. As I say, we're all familiar with these things. I don't think I probably need to persuade you about them. But what I want to argue is the same applies to the subjects that we teach. The subjects we teach are not religiously neutral. The curriculum is not neutral. Our faith is relevant. Now, there's a balance to be struck there. This conference is absolutely not about retreating into some kind of obscurantic, myopic ghettoism where we don't genuinely interact with mainstream thinking. As Christians, we need to be outward looking and engaging with the culture in which God has called us to serve him and preparing our pupils to do the same. And to do so on the academic level, as of course C.S. Lewis did. We'll come back to that point later. So positively, why should we do it? First of all knowledge is connected. You may have seen the quotation from Abraham Kuyper flash up on the screen during lunch. He said, "No single piece of our mental world is to be hermetically sealed off from the rest." As Christians, we say we love the truth. And lots could be said in answer to the question, what is truth? But one key way, which I think almost everyone accepts, we can recognize truth, is that truth is consistent. Truth does not contradict itself, it's coherent. If two things genuinely contradict one another, then one or both things must be false. If our Christian beliefs and what we communicate in the teaching of our subject contradict one another, then one or both are false. And this is not just some abstruse philosophical point. It has very real consequences in the life of schools and of young people. And I'll just give you one example of that. We know that non-Christians will often send their children to Christian schools because they value their distinctive approach to education, their distinctive approach both pastorally, perhaps in terms of exam results too. And if a student who is perhaps not from a Christian background comes to a Christian school, they're going to hear what Christians believe, in assemblies, for example. They might come to understand that Christians believe that the purpose of life is to know God, to know his love, to share that love with others, and to bring him glory both now and in eternity, and to seek his righteousness. However, if the curriculum is then presented to them as being only, let me emphasize that only, about getting good qualifications in order to get a good job, in order to have a good standard of living, i.e. to learn lots of money, or to avoid an occupation that has a low social status. If you don't work hard, you'll be getting nothing in your GCSEs. You don't end up driving bin lorries, do you? Then the teaching in assembly is completely undermined. The student can just dismiss it. I'm not religious, so that religious stuff in assembly is not relevant to me. I'll just ignore it. It's just something I have to put up with at this school and make the most of the good teaching I'm getting in my lessons. They can do that because that teaching in lessons is utterly disconnected from the teaching in the assembly. I don't know if any of you have come across that attitude amongst students. I've certainly seen it in more than one school. That shouldn't be happening. We need to be authentic. Not saying one thing in one context and showing we don't really believe it in another. We need to be consistent and inspire pupils with a coherent Christian view of reality, whilst, of course, acknowledging other views as well. So that's the first point. Secondly, our contemporary ideas about maths and English and science, geography, French, etc., haven't just sprung into existence out of nowhere. They've developed as a work of people. People with their own particular views on all sorts of things and in their own particular historical context. In other words, the subjects of the curriculum are cultural things. And just as we as Christians look at our wider culture, popular culture, civic culture, etc., and we have mixed feelings, seeing some things that are good, that are in harmony with God's ways, that we can really delight in, and some things that are emphatically not, that are in rebellion against him, we can also look at our academic culture and our educational culture with critical eyes. Not critical in the sense of being negative, but critical in the sense of being discerning. So that's my second point. It's not that we have to rethink everything and come up with completely alternative maths, English, history, science, etc. These subjects are all shaped by an external reality, in fact, an external reality created by God, which we all live in, Christian and non-Christian. And it's an external reality that I believe everybody naturally has an insight into, because our minds themselves ultimately come from God. He's equipped us to be stewards of his creation. But we're finite, and our knowledge is incomplete. More than that, we're fallen, and all our knowledge and understanding is distorted by our own pride, our desire for autonomy from the Creator, by our idolatry. And as Christians, we need to be sensitive to that as we approach our subject, so we need to be discerning. And that brings me to my third point. We must not lead our students into idolatry. Let's have a brief look at Colossians chapter 1, starting from verse 15. I've got it there on the screen. I'll just read it. So here Paul is speaking of Christ Jesus, and he says, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross." In other words, what Paul is saying is that everything that there is owes its origin to Christ. And that every aspect of creation, earthly and heavenly, is called to be submitted to the kingship of Christ and is being redeemed by him. Again, this could be misunderstood. We're not talking about theocracy. We're not talking about a Christian empire. Jesus said his kingdom was not of this world. But it does mean that as Christians, we have accepted Christ's kingship over our own lives, and we should seek to bring all of our lives under his authority, under his gracious redemptive rule, and that includes our professional lives. And Christian schools should be under his authority, including the curriculum. So coming back to why, the third point, we must not lead our students into idolatry. We believe that human autonomy, the rejection of God's authority to go our own way, leads to disaster. We see that in Genesis 3 and throughout Scripture. And in John's glorious vision in Revelation, we see the final consummation of Jesus Christ's rule, with all the redeemed treasures of the nations being brought into the heavenly Jerusalem, the place where God lives with his redeemed people. Well, we should be beginning that now, bringing our subjects and our teaching under his rule and under his glory. And furthermore, the Bible is clear that those who teach have a greater responsibility, perhaps greatest of all for those who teach children. Jesus reserves some of his sternest warnings to this topic when he speaks about millstones and depths. We have a responsibility in our teaching not to point our students away from God and towards some other God, leading them into idolatry. For example, Jesus teaches we cannot serve both God and mammon, i.e. the pursuit of worldly possessions and material success. A friend of mine puts it in this rather provocative way, referring to the Canaanite god Molech, whose worship is condemned in the Old Testament, and that was worship that involved child sacrifice. And the way he puts it is, he says, "Are we sacrificing our children to mammon?" Our students, our pupils, cannot serve both God and the pursuit of pleasure or self-fulfillment or looking after number one or seeking their own reputation or social and political influence for their own sake or environmental crusading or pride in human mastery over creation in technology. I'm not saying those things are bad in themselves. Pleasure's not bad in itself. Riches aren't bad in themselves, but we can only find our fulfillment in Christ. It's good to have social and political influence, but only if they can be used for good and in God's service. It's right to be concerned about the environment over which God has made us stewards. Technology can be used in a good way, but if they become an aim in and of themselves for our students, then our students become enslaved to the pursuit of them, devoting their lives to serving an idol that will never fully satisfy them. Jesus said, "He who is not for me is against me." Similarly, our teaching will be pointing our students either towards God or away from him. Now, there are, however, some things that we need to be careful of here, I think. We'll shortly move on from the why to the how, but before we do that, I think we do need to deal again with indoctrination. It's already been mentioned this morning. We have to acknowledge that our pupils make their own choices. We don't make their choices for them. And God will hold them responsible for their choices. We can point them in one direction or another, but they're responsible for their own lives. And the charge of indoctrination is often leveled at Christian educators and others teaching from a religious perspective. Some Christians respond to this by saying, yes, we do indoctrinate. That's part of good education. What's more, all schools indoctrinate children. It's not whether you indoctrinate, but what you indoctrinate them with, which is the question. And of course, that is true. Pupils really are being indoctrinated every day in secular viewpoints all across the country. But although that's true, I think it brings two dangers with it. First of all, people in the secular mainstream don't get what we're saying about secular indoctrination. So all they hear us saying is that we think indoctrination is a good thing and that we're admitting that's what we're trying to do, which is profoundly unhelpful to the cause of Christian education. And secondly, it can make us uncritical of our own practice. I mentioned earlier the need to be discerning. That isn't just about being discerning of the contributions of non-Christians to our academic and educational culture. It's also being discerning of Christians and of ourselves, because we also are fallible and fallen. There are some things which I think could broadly be put under the heading of indoctrination, which I think are wrong, and which I've summarized on this slide. First of all, pretending that the Christian view of something is what everyone thinks. First of all, that's dishonest. Secondly, it doesn't prepare students to deal with the other views they'll find within society in which they will live and which they may serve God. And thirdly, it means that when students encounter other views about which we as teachers have been silent, it suggests to them that we didn't tell them the whole story and undermines the credibility of the Christian view. Another trap that we could fall into is acknowledging there are other views, but distorting those other views so it's easy for us to dismiss them. And again, that's dishonest and unhelpful for all the same reasons. Both are trying to dishonestly manipulate students into believing the Christian view. We don't need to do that. All truth is God's truth, and the truth will out. If we think we need to distort the truth in order to convince people that Christianity is true, we have to question the state of our own faith, whether we really believe it's true. We should be relaxed and confident in God and in his truth. And we must also respect our pupils as those who themselves are made in the image of God, who are whole beings with hearts, minds, critical faculties, emotions, etc., all of which need education and which need to be engaged in the learning process. Number three is a little different. It's almost the opposite of the previous two errors. Let's not overreact to number one and two on the slide by presenting huge varieties of different perspectives on every point with equal weight, refusing to make any commitment as teachers, leaving our pupils in a sea of confusion and suggesting to them that they can't know anything. I mean, this is, Mark's already mentioned that this morning in connection with character education. We don't need to present every viewpoint on every topic to children. As teachers, it's our responsibility to lead them in the right way, and we need to be sensitive to their age and maturity and their ability to handle different viewpoints. So if we move on to how we could do this briefly. There's two aspects of this. There's looking at the actual subject content, which has been shaped by our academic culture. And the other aspect is how we go about communicating it, our educational culture. and I'm suggesting we need to be discerning about both. But it's probably true to say that for most of us as teachers in schools, number two is where our efforts will be mainly, though not exclusively, focused as school teachers. Number one is perhaps more in the calling of our university colleagues, but we shouldn't ignore it. So it's about, number two is about how we express things, the examples we choose, the tasks that we set. There obviously isn't time to go into detail on every subject in the curriculum, nor could I do that. Perhaps there might be some time to share ideas about this later. But let's look at how we could start to understand this, how we could start to approach subjects within the curriculum. We've looked at why it's important. We looked at some of the things it doesn't mean. How can we do this? Well, most people have a big story. The technical word is a meta-narrative, which we use to understand the world. It's the big picture of what we think is going on in the universe and in humanity. And I'd like to just briefly contrast the Christian view of this and a secular view of this. I hope you'll recognize the Christian meta-narrative, the top line on the slide there. You can almost view it as a summary of the Bible. But it isn't just that. Just as the Bible itself is not just a 2,000-plus-year-old historical document, though it is that, but it's also God's living word to us now. So this is the big story of where we believe we have come from, what we believe the key events are that have shaped human history, or shaped history, I shouldn't just say human history, shaped history, and what will happen in the future. But it's also our story. It's a story of which we as Christians are part. Let me just take you through it. We recognize that we are made in God's image, that we live in a purposeful and moral world made by him. But that is also a world in which there's real evil, which impacts on everything we see. We can read of ancient Israel in the Old Testament of the Bible, and both learn from their relationship with God and see how it was incomplete and ultimately left sin unresolved and pointed forward to Christ. And we can recognize that we now are not part of ancient Israel. That's not our place in the story. We can look back to Jesus' incarnation, life, death, and resurrection as the turning point of history and as what brings about the turning point in our own lives. And we can see how out of his work, the church was born on the day of Pentecost, living in the light of all that had gone before and looking ahead to the new creation. And that's where we place ourselves within this story too. Living out our lives in a beautiful but fallen world, fallen ourselves, but being transformed into the likeness of Christ who has gone before us into heaven. And this story provides a framework for us to understand our lives as a whole and a context within which we interpret the details of our lives, whether we could actually draw it out or not, as it is on the slide. Underneath that, the secular meta-narrative, as you can see, is quite different. It's meant to represent how a lot of people in our culture understand things. And of course, there's variations on the theme there. This doesn't sum up everybody's view. But you can see out of this universe that exists by chance emerges humanity, which evolves consciousness and intelligence. That sets humanity apart from the rest of nature. We have the ability to develop ideas which can be passed down the generations, not just genes that are passed down. And this will ultimately allow us to transcend evolution and our biological limitations. At the Enlightenment, humanity began to put superstition behind it. And as we did so, the scientific revolution occurred, bringing true knowledge of our universe for the first time, giving us the power to shape our destiny with technology. And through technology and scientific understanding, we can find better ways to address the problems of this world and make ever more progress, casting off outdated patterns of thought, embracing the power of technology. So it's a radical view, really, of human progress. And you'll come across this sometimes when you might express a view and someone will say, how can you say that in 2016? As if the date had some relevance to the rightness or wrongness of a moral proposition. We might find our beliefs described as medieval. But the flip side of this narrative of human progress is that there's no predetermined purpose to life, because it was just an accident. There's no absolute morality or even absolute laws of logic, because there's nowhere for them to come from. So our lives are our own to make of what we please. Our own individual goals are what are most important in shaping our lives, not our duties to others or to God. With no God to be true to, the most important thing becomes being true to ourselves. And Walsh and Middleton, in a book they wrote called The Transforming Vision, they've got a sort of parody of this, and they say, the absolutization of science in the Renaissance fathered a tremendous technology which brings salvation, and the blessing and presence of these humanistic deities are today mediated to us through the economistic consumer society in which we live and move and have our being. The high god scientism, in its omniscience, conceived a divine plan and sent the son of technical mastery to subdue nature for our benefit. Divine reason took on flesh in the scientific technological quest of the natural world. When the disciples of the new religion gathered at the Industrial Revolution, the spirit of capitalism was outpoured. And now in these last days, we are filled with this spirit and empowered to do mighty acts of production and consumption, looking for and hasting the day when the invisible hand will cause the blessings of this economistic age to trickle down to all nations. And in that day, everyone, great and small, will have prosperity. From the beginning of time, never has such a day been. Wealth will cover the earth, and weeping and toil will be no more. Now, it's not that as Christians, we don't believe that some of these things have happened. There may be some debate about some of them. It's not that we don't value things like scientific and technological development. In fact, key figures in the scientific revolution cited their Christian belief explicitly as the inspiration for their work. But the point is, we don't believe that science, technology, and economics provide the ultimate answers to the human condition. Nor do we believe that we as humans define our own purpose, or that we've invented morality. Ultimately, we believe we must look to God and not to ourselves. Why am I going through this with you? Because the more we immerse ourselves within the biblical story, within God's word, the more we allow it to shape our own lives and thinking, the more we will reflect Christ in our teaching. And the better we understand secular views, the more discerning we will become, better at spotting where we have slipped into secular thinking in our teaching. And because explicitly drawing out these stories is helpful for us as we begin to look at individual subjects within the curriculum. So how could we begin then to implement some of these things in the school? How could we translate it into practice? Well, there's a variety of schools represented here today. Independent Christian schools, on the one hand, who have founded on some of this thinking, and some of you who may be Christians working in schools that have no faith commitment at all. And we need to work out what it means in our own context. But frameworks can be a helpful way of trying to approach this and sharing thoughts and plans across a school with a number of different staff. I'm going to have to be very brief because I've only got 2 or 3 minutes left. But there's a few things I've just pointed out there on the slide. There's a website called What If Learning. And that's a good place to look if you want a fairly light touch approach to this. I think it's important to be realistic. You're not going to get every teacher in a school on board with deep philosophical analysis. And What If Learning is a very good sort of, as I just say, a light touch approach that would be appropriate in many schools which are explicitly faith schools. Another framework I'll just mention. Plumber, can you just skip 2 slides, please? That's it. Thanks. Is the framework of awe and wonder, grief, placed in the story, and action. I've just got time, I think, to give an example of this. And the example I'm going to choose is art. So how would you put art into this scheme? Well, in art, we look at awe and wonder. We look at awe and wonder because we're in a universe created wonderfully by God. And in art, we look at the marvelous beauty of creation, the whole of nature, and in particular the human form, order and beauty and symmetry, line, color, light, texture, shape, size, diversity. These things ultimately have their origin in God, and that's why they're beautiful and wonderful. We look at the creative gifts of human beings, which reflect the creativity of the God who made us in his image. We look at the richness of communication possible in art, conveying emotions, situations, perceptions of reality from the artist to the viewer, sometimes from one age to another. Isn't it just amazing? You can look at a piece of art that was produced hundreds of years ago and across the ages that can communicate to you. We can have awe and wonder at the use of art to comment upon or protest against evil in society, or the power of great art, works of art to move the viewer. The ability of small acts of aesthetic consideration to transform the environment from dehumanizing utilitarian drabness. I mean, I think of the kind of flats that were put up in Soviet era Russia. Transform that to something special, which acknowledges the creative, artistic dimension of the humanity that God has made us with, which even reflects his own creativity. But because we live in a fallen world, in every subject there is grief. And we live in a culture that likes to ignore that and likes to pretend everything is fine sometimes. And a true Christian approach, I believe, to every subject should actually honestly draw attention to the grief there is in the world. Art used to express human rebellion against God, delighting in ugliness, denying the beauty of what God has made. The degradation of the aesthetic dimension of God's creation through the fall. The frustration of the elusiveness of artistic expression. You can't quite capture or express the thought and communicate to others that you had. The use of art to demean and oppress groups of people or to distort the truth, for example, in propaganda. But of course, we don't just live in a created and fallen world. We live in a world into which Christ has come, which he is redeeming, in which he brings hope. And it's a world in which our pupils and us as teachers have a part. We're part of the story. So, and a Christian approach to art would look at our place in the story, the history of art and artists, trends and cultural centres, development of technique, skills and form, the way art has reflected and shaped the changing values and attitudes of our culture, the diversity of art forms from other cultures. It gives a context, a broad context, within God's sovereign plan over history. And as I say, because we live in a world that is being redeemed, it's not hopeless despite its fallenness, we should be responding with action, and so should our pupils. The Bible doesn't know anything, this kind of detached theoretical knowledge. When the Bible speaks about the use of the word know, it's always in a practical sense. When we know something, we're placed under an ethical, it places ethical demands upon us. So what action should flow from our learning? Our pupils should be developing their gifts of creativity and communication. They should be recognizing the value of God's creation in the exercise of their creativity, responding to God's creation with their creativity, experiencing catharsis through art, appreciating art and discerning what is good, reading works of art and evaluating their message. They can be promoting the aesthetic aspect of the school and community, using art to help others and to be a blessing to other people, producing artwork for display in hospitals or other locations in the community to give pleasure to others. Because the artistic gifts are gifts given to us, given to our pupils from God, to use in his service. And another action would be being humble in the appreciation of others' creative gifts and the limitations of human expression in the context of the glory of God's creation. And isn't it incredible, really, even when you reflect on the most beautiful and amazing work of art from the greatest master, that a cobweb in the dew rivals it for beauty, that smallest, most trivial part of God's beautiful creation, and we should be giving the glory to God for that. Well, it's gone 1:45, and I was told to stop at 1:45. I have got a number of other slides, and I can't see anybody from the other seminars back down here yet. So, okay, so I'll press ahead. I'll press ahead. 60 seconds, okay, 60 seconds. I was going to talk about French, and I was going to talk about science. I won't talk about them, but I'll let you see the slides, so you can guess what I might have said. I was going to look at modern foreign languages and look at how we could insert that within our two views, a secular meta-narrative and a Christian meta-narrative, and how we could use that to inform our teaching And that was some of the things I was going to say about that. And then I was going to do the same thing with science. But I think I will stop there. Yes, I will stop there. I don't think I can really get started on any other things. Time for maybe one question.
I actually taught Sunday school. I taught the whole story of the Tower of Babel last week, and it's only just now that I thought, oh, actually, there is a connection.
Absolutely.
Because it was God's plan for people to spread out across the world, and people deliberately went against that and grouped together to build this tower against God.
Yes, that's right.
And the reversal, yes, I
think. Yeah. Yeah, the reversal at Pentecost then. So Tower of Babel, the human autonomy and pride and trying to set themselves up as God is frustrated. But the tower, but at the day of Pentecost, in the beginning of the church, the disciples speak in all the languages, showing how all the languages are going to be brought in. And then you can look again forward to Revelation and see how all tribes and tongues are used to the glory of God. And the riches of all the nations pour into the New Jerusalem, which I think perhaps is perhaps culture as well as language. And I think that does give an important context. And also in language teaching, you can look at the purpose of speaking other languages. Is it just so we can go on holiday abroad and buy the things we want to buy? Is that what message is it giving to children if that's what our focus is on? Or is it about meaningfully communicating with other people and the use of language to show love and hospitality? What even languages should we be looking at in schools? Should we be just focusing on French, or should we perhaps be considering community languages and languages spoken by immigrant communities that might be living in a neighborhood? And what would it do to students' motivation if they were able to genuinely communicate with such people in their own language rather than just learning a language that perhaps they might never use in reality for genuine communication? But I must stop there. I know we've got a little time to sum up at the end. So thank you.